so charming. Fa la la la
disclaimer.
La 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 la. Nick, the Yuletide, Grace, and Ollie. Fa la la la.
The views and opinions here expressed by the members of the Tool Show are not the views of Anime News Network.
Fa la 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 la. Chalk from all those caroling singers. Fa la 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 la.
Hey everybody, welcome to Ancast. I'm Zach Burchy. Justin's here.
Hey everyone.
And it's time, once again, for our annual holiday special. Normally, you know, when we did these in the past, there was some kind of a top 10 or whatever, but we've kind of exhausted those, and this year we decided to, right? I mean, not much left in terms of lists we can do. So this year we decided to go ahead and do a movie and anime swap, which we'll explain here in a little bit, but first up top, couple of things to talk about. I talked about this a little bit on the previous episode, which we're kind of cramming all this in right before Christmas. So I taped the previous episode yesterday, or late last night, actually. And we're taping this the next day. And on the previous episode, we talked about Wolf Children and how I was kind of let down by it. And I know you saw it, and I really want to hear what you thought of that movie.
I was kind of let down by it.
Okay.
Sorry. I mean, it's, well, I had a number of things that I was thinking while I was watching it, which is, boy, I hope this goes somewhere. Boy, I hope this goes somewhere. Oh, this isn't going anywhere, is it? Mm. Okay, it's just this.
Yeah.
And then I was talking about it on Twitter and on Facebook a little bit, and a friend of mine just messaged me just one line that completely ruined everything for me. Isn't it a much bigger problem that Hosoda's last two movies have been furry bait? And I was really trying so hard not to think about that. But holy shit, his last two movies have been furry bait.
I took a screenshot while we were watching that movie of the ridiculous-looking wolf boy with blue anime hair. And I think the caption I added to it was Mamoru Hosoda's DeviantArt children. Like, I was so let down by that design choice. It's so poor. Like, that looks so bad.
That didn't bother me so much. The woman on wolf sex scene did in an otherwise family film.
Well, somebody was describing Hosoda was at something. He was at a convention, an American convention, and someone asked him directly about that. Some furry came up to the mic and asked directly whether or not he was interested in the anthropomorphic arts or whatever the fuck phrasing he used. And I think
if he was into yiffing.
Yeah, and Hosoda, and based on the description of this event, Hosoda kind of shrunk down and was like, I only found out about this stuff after I started making these movies. Like, which I'm not sure I believe.
I might not believe that either, but it's, you know, one of those things where actually there are people who are not furries that, you know, kind of got into the idea of liking anthropomorphic characters organically without attaching it to weird sexual hangups.
Well, what I would prescribe that to is probably watched a lot of cartoons like in the 80s and the 90s and then just never went on the internet.
Right.
Or just didn't spend any time on the internet, like never typed Tiny Toon Adventures into Google. Or, you know, what Metacrawler, whatever the search engine was.
Never went, oh, wow, Babs with a boner.
Yeah, so the sex part of it never came into it. It's just like, oh, I just like Looney Tunes. I just like Animaniacs. It never became a sex thing.
So I can imagine just accidentally finding yourself backing into that.
Yep.
Would be one of the most horrifying things I could imagine as a director.
Right, I can believe it. It's plausible.
It is plausible. I'm really trying to believe this.
I want to believe it.
I really want to believe this. Because the last thing we need is, you know, one of the last great hopes for anime directors basically, you know, smash cut to 10 years from now and he's making furry hentai.
Yeah, I don't know about that, but Lord, do I want him to break out of this I'm the next Miyazaki thing. Funimation was advertising the film as he's the next Miyazaki, and I'm like, God, I hope not. I hope he's not the next Miyazaki. I want him to be the first Mamoru Hosoda. I just don't want another fucking cicadas and railroad tracks and crystal blue skies and, oh, elementary school memories and just enough. Enough with the nostalgia wallow. Like, he's a very talented director. I want to see him do more. More than this, you know?
Yeah, and so, Summer Wars was way more than this.
Yeah, it was. I'm not as big a fan of that movie as you are, but Summer Wars had its amount had its fair amount of treacle.
Sure.
And I want him to get away from treacle, but maybe that's his thing. So, you know, maybe I'm expecting too much. But what did you think of the character? Because my biggest problem with Wolf Children is the characterization of the mother.
Yeah, well, that by far is the biggest issue with the film is storytelling. It does not work as a story simply because she is not a character.
No, she's a super mom.
Yeah, I mean, there is never any tension. The whole story is, you know, wow, look at everything that she has to do to raise these kids. But there's never any tension because it's never even explored for a millisecond. Not only can she do this, of course she can, but is she going to ever break? Are the pressures ever going to get to her? No, they never do. No. She is literally not a character. She is an idealized thing, and therefore it's almost impossible to care. She is invincible.
Yeah. She never has a bad parenting moment. She never breaks. There's a momentary crisis.
At one point, she takes what should have been a borderline lethal accident and just walks away from it, no problem.
Yeah. There was a moment in the thread, because Hope reviewed this for us, and in the thread, people were defending it, and, you know, of course, you know, and saying, like, you know, and I said, like, well, she's super mom. She never makes any mistakes. Every crisis is resolved in seconds. You know, even when child services comes knocking, she just moves to the country into a giant house that magically turns into this sort of estate, like, you know, nicely decorated, appointed estate, seemingly with very little money. Like, they said, like, oh, Dad didn't leave us much money, but they had just had money all the time. I guess.
Yes, and suddenly she's growing her own vegetables.
Yeah, suddenly she's doing that. Well, you know, there was a whole montage. That stuff.
Sure,
felt like
but it just if you're going to strain credibility,
yeah.
And it does a lot.
Yeah,
you have to be emotionally invested to a point far beyond that this film is capable of.
Yeah, exactly.
That you're willing to give it a pass.
If I really cared about these characters, I wouldn't care about any of that stuff. But I didn't.
Right.
So, you know, it's one of those things. But somebody goes, oh, yeah, she totally has a struggle. Remember the scene where the girl eats, like, silica gel or something like that? And then...
And she makes one panicked phone call and that's the end?
Well, and I said, that's a gag. The entire reason that scene is in there is so she can go, do I take her to the vet or to the hospital? But yuck, it's a gag. And then it's resolved with a phone call. Like, give me a break. That's not like, oh, she certainly struggles. Like, come on. Come on. No way.
she struggles less than Rosie from the Jetsons struggles.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the thing. Like, I get it. It's a love letter to his single mom, but he then chose to tell the story from the perspective of the little girl. And if you're writing something that's supposed to be a little bit autobiographical, which, you know, I assume this is because that's the experience he's writing from. He's writing from the experience of growing up with a single mom. If this is a personal film, why didn't he write it from the perspective of the little boy?
Like, or even if it was from the perspective of the little girl. I mean, I'm sorry, mothers and daughters fight. Mothers are wrong about things.
Yeah. Yeah, that's why I didn't attach to it, because it felt like this totally idealized relationship. And that's just, that's not human for me. That's not human enough. It feels...
For you, it's not human, period.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. If they'd have had even one thing where, you know, maybe she snores or she, like, got really gassy for a couple days, that would be something, anything.
Yeah.
She is utterly flawless, and it has all the suspense of watching someone blow through Super Mario Brothers with Game Genie, where you're constantly, you know, invincible.
Yeah.
It's like, this is not interesting.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I wasn't engaged, and by the end, I was waiting for it to be over. And I don't, I don't want that to happen in his films, because I think he's all potential. But he's at the very early part of his career. We'll probably see a lot more from him.
So, I don't know about very early. Dude's pushing 50.
Well, for an anime guy.
Right. That's true. Yeah, we haven't a good 20 years yet. Knock on wood.
So, you know, he's got probably 20, 25 years left. So that's, you know, one film every 3 years or so, two, 3 years.
Yeah. I hope
he branches out. I hope it's not just going to be this kind of thing. A lot of people really like it, and I totally get it. But to me, like, the ultimate litmus test on this one was Lindsay's opinion. Lindsay Lam, who's one of our news editors, who is a single mom. And she saw it and was like, this is some bullshit.
Well, I'll bet, because she knows, you know, as a single mom, she knows what, you know, the warts and all, the real struggles.
Yeah, she has like a 3 or 4 year old. And she's like, this woman never breaks down. That is not what being a single mother is like at all.
It's not what a mother is like. I mean, I'm sorry. Raising kids is really tough. Raising two kids is really tough. Raising two borderline feral kids.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And the little boy has no character either. He's just kind of there. And
yeah, he's just, I mean, it's just, here's the thing. A lot of directors think they're writers and they're just not. Mm. And Hosoda actually wrote this.
Yeah.
So and it needed to have someone else go over it. It needed at least another draft. It needed editors. It's not there. It is not a good script.
Nope. Not at all. Anyway, well, we're on the same page.
Children.
We're on the
anger same and disappointment.
Yeah, yeah. I think we're on the same page on that one. So, but before we do our movie and anime swap thing, I did want to kind of get your take on maybe what was the best, because we're at the end of 2013 here. And you and I both are in agreement that we feel like we haven't seen the best movie yet, because all the really good stuff isn't out yet.
Right.
I think we're both looking forward to the same films. Like, I really want to see Her and Wolf of Wall Street, and those aren't out yet. So,
yeah, Inside Llewyn Davis.
Yeah, Inside Llewyn Davis. That's out. I just haven't seen it. It opens tomorrow. Yeah. Here, but, I haven't gotten to a lot of that stuff yet. So
we've been busy.
Yeah.
It's the holidays.
We'll talk about it in the future, you know, January podcasts. nothing really to say on that front, but in terms of anime, I was curious maybe, and it doesn't necessarily have to be something from this year, but just maybe the best thing you saw this year. I had trouble with this too, because I wasn't really sure what to say. It's been a good year. I think we got plenty of material that people like you and I tend to enjoy.
Right.
But picking a best is sort of tough.
Actually, I think my favorite thing that I saw this year was Princess and the Pilot.
Really? See, I still haven't seen that.
Oh, I absolutely, like, at first it seemed like a little bit of a trifle, but then the more I thought about it, the more it stuck with me, and I just, it's become one of my, you know, go-to great anime movies.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I'll definitely have to see it then.
Yeah, it's, that now that I think about that, that's like, okay, duh, easy answer. I wanted to think of that earlier. although, full disclosure, I did make the Blu-ray.
Okay, right, yeah, make sure everybody knows that. Yes. You mastered the Blu-ray for that, but you didn't make the
Blu-ray. I also make a lot of Blu-rays I don't like.
Yeah.
This is not one of them.
Yeah, you didn't work on the film.
No, I did not.
Well, that's cool. Yeah, I gotta check that out. It seemed like such a trifle, like you said. It seemed like, what is this? Some movie no one's ever heard of? Okay, never mind. I don't care.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things that just flew completely under the radar, but it's just, and the story is a whole lot of nothing, but its characterization is so rich, and it's just, it evokes such a perfect mood, and the ending is just this perfect release of all the pent-up tension and frustration. It's just, I don't know, it's just, either it was a happy accident or the director Jun Shishido, I think his name is one of the ones to watch. It could be. I don't know. All of his other stuff is, you know, okay. Like, he did Tale of Sengoku and a couple other things. It's just, he's never popped up on my radar, really, before this. But this, I don't know. I think he has promise, if this movie is any indication. There's a TV series coming out of a different book in the series of books.
Okay.
That's coming out, I think, with a different staff, same studio, TMS.
Okay.
I think that's coming out in spring, so I'm looking forward to see what that's like.
Neat. Yeah, I'll definitely have to check it out. Although when you say like the story's a whole lot of nothing, that's where I'm going to be like, fuck this.
Well, that, yeah, that's the thing. It's kind of a, you know, typical, you know, tale of forbidden love, sort of, with, you know, across different casts. You know, a downcast guy, you know, with a princess and seeing the interplay between them. There's, you know, that's been done before a lot. And that's, even though the world approaches racism and that sort of thing in a kind of new and novel way, it's not new and novel enough to really make that noteworthy. It's just the story is just kind of background for the characters to be interesting.
Okay. Yeah. All right. I'll have to track that one down. I think for me, the best thing I saw was what I gave you for our swap. So we can just talk about that when we get into it.
Okay.
I did really like Evangelion 3.0, which I know a lot of people don't like, but I thought it was really good. I don't think it's the best thing I saw, but I did really like it. Man, people bitch about that movie. I thought it was pretty good. I guess Kill la Kill is really good. I'm enjoying that.
I didn't bother with it because I don't tend to like fun Gainax.
Oh, okay.
Well, so
you could have stopped at fun.
Thank you.
I'm joking.
Oh yeah.
It's pretty good. I've only seen like four or five of them, and I kind of just want to get it on Blu-ray. Although it's one of those shows where like it you know, the Imaishi thing of, well, I've got X amount of dollars. I will spend $0 on all of these scenes and all of this money on these three scenes. So some of the animation is so limited, it's hilarious. And then some of the animation is absolutely gorgeous. So, you know, I'm enjoying that. But yeah, other than that, a lot of entertaining stuff that I enjoyed in the moment and, didn't really think that much about afterward. Not a lot of like standout, like holy shit, this is in my new top 10 all time kind of things.
Right.
But you know, how often does that ever happen?
Not often.
So let's get into our swap here. we did this a couple of years ago and we enjoyed doing it. So we wanted to try and do it again.
Much harder to come up with shows this time.
Yeah, I think next time we do this, we're going to have to bring some more people in.
Yeah.
And so that you and I aren't swapping with each other.
I've kind of exhausted my stash of hidden gems that you haven't seen.
Yeah. Well, the anime this time, I got the impression that you were maybe out of stuff to recommend.
You've seen everything because I've been recommending you stuff for years.
Yeah, that's true. Well, also, I work in this line. This is my line of work, so I've seen lots of anime. you are impossible to recommend things to, except you don't watch anything new, so that made it easier for me this year.
Well, not nothing new, but I barely watch simulcasts.
You don't keep up with the new season, so
no.
If there's something really good or cool, I can totally,
I just you know. Finished Free.
Yeah. I want to finish that show, although I don't know if it's worth such a trifle.
It's fun. I mean, if you like sports anime, you'll like it.
Oh, forgot to mention in the, you know, discussion of the best stuff of the year, Flowers of Evil, of course.
Yeah, I mean, the ending kind of torpedoed that for me.
Yeah, because I thought...
Because it's just not an ending?
Well, I thought they were going to have some balls and actually stick to the whole, we don't care about making a sequel, this is going to be 12 episodes of this, and it doesn't matter, but the ending is, read the manga! For more information on Flowers of Evil, check out the manga! And it's like, don't do that. Like, just close your story off.
You already knew you weren't going to get another season.
Yeah, so just close your story off. End it. Don't make it, like, check out this more of the story. It's stupid.
It's not like you were... They weren't out of material.
Yeah.
And they weren't under any time constraints, because Lord knows they could have lost a third of that show and not, you know, really missed out on anything.
Nope. More than a third, I would say half.
Right.
But I enjoyed the act of watching that show, and That episode where they wreck the classroom is, I would say that that episode is probably the best thing I saw this year.
Yeah, very, very, very ballsy stuff, and I wish more anime would take chances like that, but it's not really paid off for, you know, chance anime to take risks.
Yeah,
largely.
Exactly. Well, and for that show especially, boy, that didn't pay off for them. Anyway, so the rules are we pick three anime and three movies, and we swap them, and it has to be something you haven't seen that the other person has a reason for recommending it to you. Mm-hmm. This year, I broke the rules a little bit by just giving you one TV show because the total runtime is... I can't give you one TV show and then more shit.
Right, because that was 5 hours of content.
Yeah, I can give you the one show.
Yes.
And so we'll start with the anime swap here. And why don't we talk about what I gave you? Because, like I said, aside from that one episode of Flowers of Evil, I would say this is the best thing I saw this year.
Okay, well, the anime you gave me was Watamote.
Right.
Which I had not seen. I what soured me on it initially, sadly, was doing Spotlight.
Okay.
Because the trailer was awful, and it used the stupid end theme of Tomoko singing badly, and it left a bad taste in my mouth. Oh, this is a stupid gag anime, you know, on this gut visceral level, and I just checked out.
Right.
So I went back and watched it, and I fully understand why you recommended it to me. Can't say I enjoyed it.
Yeah, I wouldn't. Well, watching
enjoying
it is not,
such a strange word to apply to the show because it is not fun to watch.
No, did it play?
In fact,
you,
it's outright unpleasant to watch in places.
Did it play to you like a comedy?
A very, very cringy, like dark Ben Stiller comedy in the first half.
Ben Stiller.
I'm sorry, not Ben Stiller. Okay, almost like a British comedy where it's just like, oh, don't do that, don't do that. Oh, God, he's doing it, or she's doing it.
Right.
It's cringe humor. But it is humor, and she is very deluded. At the end, I really thought it kind of fell apart as Tomoko, the main character, sort of stopped living in her fantasy world. Okay. And just kind of quietly sits there and realizing how lonely and depressed she really is. And although that's compelling to a point, she doesn't really do much about it. Or there's no real turning point. It's just like, yep, she's still depressed, the end.
Well, okay, you're not wrong about that, but I feel like it would have been, like, the show, I think, is an extremely accurate depiction of a person with those particular issues.
Yeah, social.
It doesn't seem fake to me, and it's not played, the show is sort of a comedy, but it doesn't play really as a comedy to me. It's more like you're observing this character, and it's a fully realized character, and it is just a character study. It's more of a portrait rather than a real story.
Its real value. It's truthful in a way about this stuff that even Welcome to the NHK wasn't.
Exactly, and I feel like had there been some sort of 11th hour heel turn, some sudden realization that, you know, oh, I'm going to fix this, or I'm going to get better, or if she actually had fixed her problems somehow, it would have felt false. The kind of issues she has, those are the kind of things where, unless they'd done like a time skip 20 years later and she's been in therapy for a really long time, you know, then you would sort of accept a fixed up version of this character. But doing it the way they did felt more realistic to me and true to the character, and stuck to its guns. They didn't give you a happy ending. They gave you a glimmer of hope that maybe she's now self-aware enough to maybe change somewhere down the line. But that's all you get. And to me, that's way more realistic and way more ballsy than any more than that. And it would have felt false to me.
Right. I can't really, it's hard for me to think about what I wish this show would have done differently. For some sort of resolution, because the main character needs to be in therapy badly.
Right.
She probably not needs to be on Lexapro or some sort of antidepressant just to bump her out of this horrifyingly depressed, socially isolated state that she's in. And, you know, I say this from experience. I was never Tomoko level bad, but I've been, you know, my high school years were not all that far removed from this show.
Yeah, which is part of the reason, well, actually, that is the reason I wanted you to watch it, is because I know that you, like a lot of people, and myself included, had extensive experience either with these emotions or with people who have had these emotions or these issues, and that's why I wanted your take on it, is because the entire appeal of that show is your personal experience with the material. That show is a Rorschach test, I feel. I don't think you get anything out of it if you are perfectly well-adjusted and have never been around anyone who is like that at all.
Right. God, that's so hard to quantify.
Yeah.
I related to it on a certain level, but she was so, like, she was so completely over-the-top messed up.
Yeah.
That I was more frustrated that she was not getting any help at all.
Well, yeah, but I think that's...
And, like, no one was intervening because clearly, like, this is a person in trouble.
Exactly. And I think that's you now. I've known you for a very long time, and I feel like you 5 years ago would have responded to this show very differently.
Possibly.
I think so.
It's hard for me to get back in that mindset because I was so... much less happy back then.
Right, right. And you're a very happy guy now. So it's interesting just to think about. Like, see, this is why I think it's such a good thing, is because there's so much to chew on in there on a personal level and about that personality type and that what the character does and what she goes through and how she deals with it and the fact that there really is no resolution.
What I think is interesting and instructive, if we're to look at Tomoko as a case study...
Mm-hmm.
Which is essentially the only real way to look at this show.
Yeah.
It's more like it's the anger that really stuck with me. The frustration and bitterness and the assumption that everyone else is a piece of garbage as a defense mechanism.
Yeah, which I feel is executed extremely realistically in the show.
Right.
Like, her attitude is like, I'm like, oh, man, I know so many people.
Absolutely. Like, you know, I would expect that being able to recognize that would be, I don't want to say cathartic, but at least strike a chord. But it didn't in me. It was kind of like, you know what it felt like almost? If I were to have all my defenses down and watch this show and be completely honest and go like, look, this was to a large extent me in high school. It would feel like I was a dog having my nose rubbed in the accident that I made on the carpet.
Really?
Yeah. It would actually make me a little defensive.
So a little painful.
Not painful so much as just like, well, it's impossible to see it without my defenses getting raised up, I think.
Well, yeah, but you've come such a long way since then, so.
Sure, but at any point, owning up to what a wrongheaded mess you were is never pleasant.
Right.
And, In this case, it's watching not just a messed up version of yourself, but a even less sympathetic, more messed up version of yourself.
Right. And you can kind of say, like, geez, at least I was never that bad.
You can, but it's just like...
That only goes so far.
I mean, yeah. I mean, I just wish there was a little bit of sugar to make the medicine go down, you know?
Yeah, and they don't give you that. And
No, they don't.
Well, and that's part of the reason why I respect it so much. Because there is, with someone who's really like that, there is no sugar. You don't get it. There's no, I don't mean you don't get the show. I mean, you don't get the relief. It's nonstop. You are inside that bell jar. And you can't, there's no getting out of it. It is a pit.
I mean, it was so out to like, you know, state that lifestyle is destructive and awful.
Yeah,
and obviously it is, but at the same time, I'm not sure there is value in saying that because it's. I feel like that life wasn't as miserable because there were small things that give you joy. And there was just, there's just no joy in Tomoko's life at all.
She found entertainment in things. Ultimately, she, you know, deemed them empty, but she did have some joy in her life. It was just all sort of solitary, small pleasures, like, you know, their Otome games and stuff like that.
Right. It did, but it didn't really get in her head.
No.
For that. It got in her head for the misery.
Right, sure. And I get what you're saying.
That's kind of not fair is what I'm saying.
Right. And I get what you're saying. I think the other reason that I admire it so much is because there's goofy, wacky shows about otaku and how lovable and zany. And look at they're such lovable nerds. And oh, gosh, we're...
Yeah, that's got to stop.
We're hikikomori and har, 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 har. And this is like, hey, a lot of you probably really relate to this, don't you? And here's the real thing. This is what it's actually like. And I thought that was just took some balls like that. That's really holding up a mirror. It's not flinching. It doesn't shy away. It doesn't let you think it's cute or funny. It really shows you just how damaging and toxic and painful and solitary that life can be. And I think it's great. I'm glad that show exists.
Well, let me ask you this. Would you ever watch it again?
No.
Yeah, I could not stand to sit through this again. And like, especially the last three episodes, which just seemed to die and wither.
The last three, because I think I said originally, because we did a whole episode on this show, and I think originally I said it's two or three episodes too long.
Yeah.
Because they weren't going to be able to move forward with the storyline really at all. Because I don't think it had been written yet at the time the show was airing, and they'd only planned on going like 12 or something like that anyway, so they weren't going to go any further with the story, but they only had maybe 9 episodes worth of things to talk about and explorations of that character. So they ran out of stuff at like episode 9, I think, and 10, 11, 12 are kind of... But anyway.
Yeah, that last... basically, once it started with the festival, they seemed to not know what to do with her.
Yeah, yeah. I agree with you. The ending is a little bit of a mess, but not enough to wreck the rest of the show for me, and not enough to make me think, like, oh, this... You know, I will recommend it... I would recommend that show to anyone who has not seen it. You're right, I don't think I'll ever watch it again, but it left a real big impression on me, and that's why I think it's the best thing I saw. This year,
I wish it got into the anger more. I don't know. I'm like, I could relate to it just enough that I felt like it applied to me, but not enough that I felt like it told what I wanted something to say about that.
Well, I mean, at the same time, have you even seen like a live action film that dealt with that kind of personality, that kind of crippling social anxiety that directly? Because I couldn't think of one. I really couldn't.
That specific kind of social anxiety, especially mixed with the otaku stuff,
yeah,
is so specific to anime.
Yeah, that but yeah,
it's not. You're never going to get that exact type of social weirdness.
Yeah.
In another medium. That said, yeah, there's a few films that have come pretty close to that much isolation and anger under the surface at being isolated. All About Lily Shushu is probably the best example I can think of off the top of my head.
That was the only thing I could think of that came anywhere near it.
But that had a release, that had a resolution, it faced the anger rather than use it as comic relief for a few episodes and then forget about it.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's all in how you relate to it.
Yeah.
You know, like I said, it's a Rorschach test. Like, you wanted to see more anger. I thought it was just enough without veering into, like, the anger is expressed in the hatred of other people. You know, the subconscious, I hate all of you, why don't you love me kind of thing. Like, that's sort of where the anger is manifested, and that's in a lot of that show.
Right. A lighter version of something similar, I think, that had a lot more likability to it, and yet was still relatable on the same thing, was actually Ghost World.
Yeah, that's probably a good point. I think
my favorite line in Ghost World, by the way, he better watch out or he'll get AIDS when he date rapes her. Now, if that's not anger at your peers, I don't know what is.
I would say that if you've seen, for some reason you have not seen Ghost World, but you've seen Watamote, those two would, if Watamote were a film, they would be a great double feature.
I wonder if Shia LaBeouf has seen Ghost World.
Pretty sure he has.
We'll find out if we check his Twitter.
Well, you didn't hate the experience, right?
No, I didn't hate it, but yeah, that at the end I was totally climbing the walls. And this was, by the way, not helped at all by the fact that I had to watch it in the office because I couldn't watch it on the Crunchyroll apps for some reason. It was one of the handful of shows they have that they don't have cleared to stream to non-PC devices.
Oy.
So, yeah, that made it a little less pleasant, but
you can't just lay on the couch and yeah.
Well, I can lay on the couch in my office, but it's not exactly ideal.
Not the same, yeah.
I'm anti-laptop. That's a thing with me.
Oh, I don't like watching anything on a laptop.
Yeah,
I want it out on a. I push it out to a screen. I want to. Yeah. Okay, so since I only gave you the one thing, and you gave me three things.
Yep.
So let's go through them. Let's talk about these. The first thing I watched you gave me was Harbor Light Story from Fashion Lala. I start this thing up and it's glittery silhouettes of girls in leg warmers doing with lasers and stuff. And I'm like, oh, Justin. but eventually, so the story of this... Stop me if I'm wrong here. There is a fashion competition on this island. There is a 10-year-old girl. Dance and fashion, excuse me. Who wants to compete. And she can't because she's underage. So many anime are like this now. So she wants to compete in this competition. She has like a Saint Bernard with her. Uh-huh. And I didn't know that this was from the same franchise as Fancy Lala.
It's a kind of a early prototype.
Yeah, yeah, because it's got the little Pip and Pap, whatever they're called.
Yeah.
Mom and Pop, Dig and Dug, Dragons, whatever they're called. So she magically transforms into a Barbie doll at the end of this thing. But there's terrorists, like thug bikers, that are terrorizing the island. Living in an abandoned pirate ship. It's like a motorcycle gang, and I cannot remember their motivation for wanting to blow up everything.
The lead guy, the hot potential love interest.
For the 10-year-old. Kit,
for a 10-year-old, Kit. His dad is the mayor.
Oh, right. Okay. Yes.
And he's angry about something that isn't really entirely made clear, although a few people have pointed out that the mayor seems to be sleeping with his sister, and that might be incest? I don't know. It's an awful light little girl's story for that to be transpiring, but hey.
Yeah, this thing's only about 40 minutes long anyway.
Yeah.
So they get to the dance the fashion dance competition, which I was dying laughing, because... It's the most awkward shot of just a bunch of 80s anime girls wearing varying outfits, and they're just on a stage kind of flailing around while this music plays, and you're like, who is this supposed to be entertaining for? Of course, then they start blowing up the stadium. They, like, crash a semi-truck into the stadium, and... There's a giant explosion and...
Yeah, this is like 9/11 level destruction here.
Yeah, yeah. And it's kind of like someone crashed like a John Carpenter movie into this thing. Like, it's ridiculous. And then she transforms into a Barbie doll and starts dancing. And she's just dancing and having costume changes and dancing and everyone...
And it's not very... Like, compared to what transpires earlier in the OVA, it's not very impressive dancing.
No. It's really awkward, weird dancing.
It's like a notch down, a less cartoonishly exaggerated version of Elaine dancing.
Yes, that definitely came to mind. the Elaine dance. Really, really awkward. And basically, she sort of saves the day, or at least stops the violence through her amazing powers of dance. And then turns back into a little kid, and then the end.
Yeah, makes everything okay. All the wanton destruction, probably dead bodies everywhere. It's all good. She dances good.
Yeah, the domestic terrorism problem is solved because she wore a red sweater vest and a stupid hat and like, flailed around on stage. So I know you gave this to me as a goof, and initially I was like, what the fuck? Because it takes a while for the stupid, like, the real stupid stuff to start happening.
Right.
But once it started happening, I did enjoy it. So if you, I would say if you have some medicinal marijuana in your house, go ahead and check this out. It will amuse you. There's phantoms out there. It's super obscure.
Yeah, it's not hard to find.
No, yeah, well, it's so obscure. Like, what the fuck? Anyway, so thanks for that.
I just this mental image of Studio Puro in 1985 or wherever, 87, with like some guys in a meeting room mapping out, you know, explaining out the story outline, and anyone looking at it and going, "This is a good idea.
Great, this is great." Yeah, make sure the motorcycle guy flips over at least two cars. Oh, I want to see beards on these guys. So fucking stupid. God. But it was amusing, and a lot of design sensibility, and it definitely reminded me of like Gem. So
yeah, there's not nearly enough so bad it's good anime, and this is, I think, finally a new entry.
I would say so. Yeah, it takes a little while to get going. Once it does, it's definitely worth it.
Well, if you like 80s cheese, it doesn't take that long.
I could see this becoming like a new staple at hilariously bad anime panels.
All it needed is a really, really shitty mid-90s dub.
Oh, man. Hey. All right, so the next thing you gave me was Tokimeki Tonight, which you talked about in Pile of Shame, I think.
I've written about all these.
Yeah, you've written... Yep, right. So, Tokimeki Tonight, which I wasn't able to get my hands on the OVA version of it, so I just got a couple TV episodes.
Oh.
And it's okay. It's kind of a Munsters, Addams Family sort of thing.
Yeah, it's kind of Addams Family meets Urusei Yatsura.
That is exactly what I was going to say next. Meets series Yatsura. It's got a definite Rumiko Takahashi 80s sitcom-y vibe. So this is about a girl. Her dad is a Dracula and her mom is a wolfman. And they're in love, sort of. And she is, their spawn. And is... Okay, so I only watched two episodes of this, but it was never made clear that she is both a Dracula and a Wolfman, or just a Dracula. In the first episode, she has sort of a rival for a hunky boy at school, and her rival pisses her off to the point where she bites her, and... Well,
let's back up a little. The story goes is that her parents are really, really disappointed in her.
Yes.
Because she seems to have no powers.
Oh, right. Okay, yeah.
Yeah. And she takes it remarkably in stride, how disappointed they are with her.
Right.
She doesn't really angst at all about that her parents, like, are outright hostile to her.
Yeah. Outright hostile and to the point where now they're constantly fighting with each other about it. And right. Yeah. But what I was just kind of trying to figure out what the hell this thing is really about. And
right. So anyway, her rival for this guy bites her, pisses her off to the point where she bites her in the neck and she shapeshifts.
Yeah. She turns into her rival,
right.
Who has a giant insulting stereotype, mob boss boyfriend?
Dad. That's her dad.
That's her dad?
Yep.
Because it seemed like he was trying to fuck her the whole time.
That's Japan.
Oh, right, anime.
Right.
Yeah, it seemed like... I thought she was just calling him Papa because he wanted her to call him that.
No, actual Papa.
Ew. Okay, well, anyway. So there's an extended and not very funny comedy scene involving that. And frankly, I didn't find it. I thought this was the nothing. I didn't have much of a response to it at all. I was like, okay.
I thought it was charming.
It's forgotten. This seems like from the dustbin underneath Rumiko Takahashi's desk. Like, she came up with this and was like, I don't think so. And someone else was like, this is gold. And, you know, ran off to the studio to have it made. I didn't dislike it. I just didn't have much of a response to it. It's kind of cute and neat and totally forgotten. I don't know anyone that's... I mean, you probably, like, writing that buried garbage or the pile of shame article probably did more to expose people to this than anything else in the last 20 years.
Probably.
Yeah, it's mostly forgotten. So, you know, if the premise sounds engaging or if you're just in the mood maybe for an 80s comedy... An 80s sitcom, rather. You know, maybe check it out, but it didn't have much of an impact on me. I wasn't necessarily compelled to watch more.
Mm.
And I don't know how long it ran. Was it like 26?
It's like 40-some episodes.
Oh, okay, yeah. I don't even think this thing got... it didn't get circulated back in the fan sub days on VHS.
No, I don't think it got subbed at all. I think there's one fan subbing group doing the TV show, and they're like halfway through.
Okay. Well, yeah, anyway, that's out there. I think there's a little bit of potential in the lead character. I did find her to be sort of compelling. But the minute they started doing the shape-shifting stuff, I was like, every episode's going to be, oh no, I got mad and bit something, and now I'm that thing. And it just seems like that's destined to be the running gag.
Mm.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, those 80s comedies had running gags. That's just what they were.
And the long-suffering Dracula dad who transforms into stuff and gets hurt. okay. Yeah. I'm glad I saw it.
I keep forgetting what a giant comedy snob you are.
I totally am. You know that.
I do, but it's like, maybe Zach will like this? No. Maybe Zach will like this? No.
Well, come on. It's exceptionally corny old lady stuff. I mean, corny old lady sitcoms from America are a hard sell on anyone these days.
That's true. That is true.
you know, it's like, man, why don't you appreciate Perfect Strangers?
Kate and Ellie was some of the best television ever made.
God damn it. You're going to sit down, you're going to watch Night Court, and you're going to love it.
I actually really like Night Court. I haven't watched it since I was, like, 15, but...
Well, I suggest you don't revisit it. Okay, so the other thing you gave me was Phoenix. One of the many animated adaptations of Phoenix.
Which don't overlap at all, by the way.
No. So this one was an adaptation of the story of the demon guy who becomes a woodcarver, and then there's another woodcarver, and they, it's a little hard to describe. Do you know the exact story this is based on?
Yeah, it's the Karma chapter of Phoenix. Ho-Oh, I think they call it, because it doesn't really translate directly.
Okay, so Jason Thompson wrote exhaustively about Phoenix not too long ago. So this is based on the Karma chapter that he wrote about. The movie's not really available anywhere. Like, you said it didn't even come out on DVD, or like there's a French DVD or something?
Yeah, I found a patched, subtitle patched DVD. There's a fan sub.
Right. it's only about an hour long. So was this theatrically released, like, with something else? Like, under what conditions were this produced, do you know?
That was a movie. They're basically around, in 87, there was a movie by Rintaro and two OVAs by Kawajiri. This is the movie.
This is Rintaro.
Yes.
Huh. Surprisingly coherent for a Rintaro film.
I know, right? I think this is by far my favorite Rintaro anything. And the Rintaro things I like, I can count on one hand, wouldn't have fingers left over.
Yeah, right.
But I actually genuinely, like, I'm genuinely moved by this movie.
Let's just explain the plot here. So, we open on, it's a guy who wants to be he's in search of the Phoenix, which is... The bird where, magnificent bird where if you drink its blood, you become immortal. And he wants to find the Phoenix, and he wants to carve a sculpture of the Phoenix. And he lights a fire under a tree, and he is encountered by, it was a Goro or Guro or...
Goro. this one-armed bandit.
Yeah, this malicious bandit who cuts his arm, finds him, takes his clothes, cuts his arm, and says, well, it's your fault for lighting a fire. You know, he's the internet, basically.
Right.
It's your fault I mugged you. Why weren't you more prepared for this? Anyway, so moving forward. So then he finds a lady and rapes her. And then kidnaps her and makes her his wife. And keeps going out and raping and killing and destroying and all this stuff. And
bragging to the girl who hates him this whole time.
Yes. And I can't remember exactly what happens next. So basically he goes out and, his nose starts itching or it develops some kind of a rash. And so his kidnapped wife, quote unquote, gives him medicine. He starts rubbing it on his nose and it makes his nose worse. And his bandit pals are like, she's poisoning you. So he goes home and murders her. And it turns out she's the reincarnation of a ladybug that he saved once in his younger days. If you haven't picked up on the gigantic Buddhist theme of this whole thing, it gets ladled on even thicker. Anyway, so the woodcarver, he meets a girl in the plains, and they sort of buddy up, and they both get tracked down by bandits, and they murder the girl, and they drag off the woodcarver. This is the guy who had his arm slashed by the bandit earlier. Anyway, they both wind up in the capital, and the emperor, or the whoever he is, the daimyo or something, he wants to build Daibutsu, like a huge Buddha. So he hires this woodcarver, and he starts working on it, and then it turns out the bandit guy was so distraught by his horrible decision to murder his ladybug wife that he has just gone into the woods, given up everything, and he just spends his days carving Buddhas.
Well, realizing all the misery he's brought on the people.
Yeah, right. Realizing all the miseries he's brought and sort of atoning for it by sitting in the woods and carving Buddhas. Anyway, people start finding out, I guess, about his Buddhas, and they think they have mystical powers or something. And so, long story short, they both get wind up at the capital, and the local warlord or whatever says, okay, you're both going to build, you're both going to carve phoenix statues in tribute to the great Buddha. And so they both do, and the guy who was dead set on becoming the world's greatest woodcarver or whatever, his one is okay, but the demon guy, his one is magnificent. But I'm on the right track here. His one is magnificent, but the guy whose ultimate decision it is, he's patronizing the other guy. He's patronizing the woodcarver that wanted to be the best. And so he picks his over the other guy. They cut off the demon guy's other arm and throw him out into the woods.
Well, it's not quite that cut and dry. The woodcarver.
Cut and dry? Anyway, go on.
Thank you. The woodcarver is still pretty pissed about the mugging and basically insists as like, hey, this guy is a criminal. You can't just take his sculpture. Like, there's this rivalry here and he's out for blood.
Yeah.
And so they do. They cut off the guy's other arm and kind of just set him loose in the world to die.
Yeah, and we should point out that before all of this, the demon guy has a vision of the phoenix who tells him, "You're cool. You're going to be a great wood carver. Just keep carving, and you're gonna inspire people with your art." Basically, so the phoenix is kind of a sort of this didactic asshole that shows up and tells people what they can and can't do and what's going to happen to them. Anyway, so they pick the other woodcarver guy. After they cut the guy's arm off and he goes back out of the woods, they pick the other guy's statue, and it burns the whole imperial treasury down. And it is burning the imperial treasury down. It sort of comes to life, lights itself on fire and starts burning everything. And he runs in to try and save it and, of course, dies in the fire. And the phoenix is like, and he's laying there and he's already dead. And he has a vision of the phoenix. And the phoenix is like, well, you're going to be a fish now. And he's like, no, but I've got so much to live for. I want to be reincarnated as a great artist. And she's like, nope, fish. It's fish time for you. Sends him out, you know, reincarnates him as a fish. The end. Pan out into space where there's a satellite for some reason.
Yeah, I knew that ending would get you.
Okay, so I enjoyed watching this. It's beautifully animated. Like, really nice animation on this.
Yeah,
like,
Rintaro at top form, really, which is always amazing.
And I've always admired about his animation style the most is he's got these real thick, strong lines, and the animation is always really consistent. So it's all super on model. It's very fluid. It's got this sort of chunky kind of thickness to it that's sturdy, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen a lot of anime that is this. Basically, it was almost like Buddhist scriptures. Like, you're reading morality tales based on Buddhist dogma. That's what this felt like to me. Because that's all of this stuff. That's all Buddhist teachings. So that's what it was to me. Here this would have been on a Christian network.
Right.
If it had been similar. Obviously swapping out dogmas, but it's a morality tale based on Buddhist dogma. And I don't see anything like that. So it was a very interesting experience. Mostly I just liked the animation. For a while I was wondering where it was going. But it was a neat experience, and I definitely think people should seek it out. Yeah, I didn't have a super strong reaction to it other than that, but it was neat, and it was short. It was only about an hour, and I would like to see more, because I'm sure there's plenty of it, anime that really lays on the Buddhist dogma, like, real thick. Because you don't see anything like that.
See, I didn't even occur to me that this was Buddhist dogma.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, you know about Buddhism.
Sure. And, you know, it is rooted in Buddhist morality. But I don't know. I was taken with kind of the I was taken by the emptiness of revenge and that theme.
Right. Which is a Buddhist thing. And
well, sure it is. But, you know, I see it as a little more universal than just Buddhism.
I guess this is all heavy Buddhist imagery. And the reincarnation stuff, and the fact that the demon character goes into the woods, forsakes everything, gives up all of his earthly possessions, and is redeemed, is a super Buddhist thing like that.
I mean, sort of. There are other religions that have that.
Yeah, but that's like watching something that's obviously Christian and saying, well, other religions teach you to respect your fellow man. Yeah, but this is obviously a Christian thing. Like... That's what I
sure.
Away
I mean,
from it.
I don't know. You get out of moral tales. You know, everything goes through the prism of you know, your own experiences.
Sure, accurate.
It had a very kind of timeless and ethereal quality that got to me. I'll admit this. The, you know, 80s synth always helps that.
Yeah, I did like the soundtrack. It was nice. I enjoy that kind of thing too. So it was. His little Philip Glass esque in parts, but I did enjoy the synth. It was nice. Yeah, no, I'm really glad I got to see this. Phoenix.
Good. I was a little worried you weren't actually liking it.
Yeah, no, I did. I've never seen anything like it. I think I stuck on the this is a religious thing. Way more, obviously, way more than you did.
Sure, absolutely. Well, obviously.
But that makes it all the more fascinating to me because you don't see anything like this.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm really glad I got to see it. And of all the stuff that you gave me, you know, even though it's getting harder and harder to recommend things, I'm always really glad, you know, to get to see some of this stuff because, you know, having known you for so many years and being exposed to a lot of obscure things as a result of knowing you, it's still good. Like, there's still some stuff in there I haven't seen yet, and even though, like, one of
well, this
you
is
know,
it. It's over.
Yeah. Well, even though I didn't respond too much to Tokimeki tonight, the Harbor Light Story and Phoenix, I'm glad I saw those.
Good.
So yeah,
that makes me happy.
I would call it a success. Okay, so that wraps up anime. Then we also swapped movies.
Yep.
We did a 3-for-3 exchange, mm-hmm. and I've been talking forever here. So
okay.
Take it away.
Okay, well, let's get this one out of the way because it's the one that everyone is currently thinking about. You had me go out and see Frozen.
I did.
And I was thinking about seeing it anyway, but I'm glad you made me go out and see it because I'm not sure I would have. And I'm glad I saw it. It's cute. It definitely, as everyone has been saying, harkens back to 90s Disney Rebirth musicals.
Yeah.
It's not quite as musical theater. It is not quite to the level of Beauty and the Beast. The songs are more poppy, and they don't really advance the story any, for the most part.
Sure, yeah.
And like they're really poppy lyrically, and they're meant to be earworms and soundtrack sellers.
Yeah.
But they're fun and they're good. The animation, the character animation is impeccable. Like the body language and the subtle nuances. That said, it also felt workshopped to death.
Mm-hmm.
It is so target audience driven and clearly made for very specific audiences. I don't really know what to do with that. And it, like, the nods to the kids who are into Glee are just, it felt like watching Glee sometimes. And I'm not okay with that.
I don't know where you got that from.
It's very pageanty. There are whole musical numbers where I just kind of sat back in my seat. I'm like, oh God, we're doing this. We're doing this.
I completely disagree with that, actually. I thought the score...
The Snowman's musical sequence where he talks about summer...
It was funny.
For the first 10 seconds.
I thought that Snowman was going to be the worst fucking thing in the world, and it turns out agreed. To be totally fine.
It's actually way better than... Like, he actually has some outright funny lines.
Well, that and
I thought he was going to be a Jar Jar.
And the character serves a thematic purpose. A thematic purpose, and when you say, like, it's been focus grouped to death, that's every Disney movie. and this... you never saw Tangled, right?
No.
Okay. That... What you're talking about, like, oh, these songs are really poppy, it's not like Beauty and the Beast... Tangled, you're talking in it to me. You're talking about Tangled. Okay. This is way less poppy, like way less poppy, way less Glee. Like, I mean, I don't. Glee is to me is irrelevant. Like, I don't.
See,
really
I
get what
I
you're
am
talking about
I'm
that.
A bad gay. I hate musical theater.
Okay. Well, I love musical theater. and I love Disney musicals. And this one is as close as they've gotten to the 90s stuff, just in terms of economy of story, pacing, strong characters, great music. You remember the songs afterward. You kind of want the soundtrack. It's nice and tight. It's over in a, you know, hour and 30 minutes. And I
got to say, some of the imagery is absolutely gorgeous when, what's her name? The main character, Ice... Girl.
Elsa, yeah.
Elsa. When Elsa, you know, runs off into the forest and builds her magical ice castle and turns into Celine Dion, that was breathtaking. That was truly breathtaking. It was really pretty.
Yeah.
And she really did look like Celine Dion. That whole sequence was clearly a nod to that horrible music video for It's All Coming Back to Me.
I don't know if it's clearly that. I thought that was like the strongest musical number Disney's done in a really long time. Like,
it is a great number.
It's a great number, real strong emotionally, and beautiful imagery. Like, just great stuff. Like, I was blown away by that part. I was like, this is something else. Like, they're really trying. This is like a game for Disney feature animation. And since Pixar's been laying down on the job.
Yes, holy shit.
Like, now Disney Animation is coming in and picking it up, because between Tangled, which, you know, it's a lot poppier, but it's still a really solid movie. Wreck-It Ralph was really good. And then this, they're on the uphill climb. I feel like their stuff is a lot better. I'm more looking forward to what they're producing now than whatever Pixar has next.
I'm poking holes in this, but I don't want to give the wrong impression. I did really enjoy it. It's a solid B for me.
Yeah, I would put it as an A, but I'm a much bigger fan of the Disney stuff than you are. Like, there's no question about that.
Yep. I don't think anyone.
Yeah, I think it's I think it's their best film in a while, and I really did enjoy it way better than it has any right to be. And frankly, like you said, focus group to death. I think if it had been focus group to death, it would have been more of a prince and princess story. But this is just about those sisters and their bond together. And I think that's really
okay,
good.
Okay, focus group to death, and then there were screenwriters read too much at Jezebel.com.
Yeah, okay, fine. But I thought it was really good. I appreciated it.
It was nice to, you know, take a break from Prince. They end up together at the end. It was a good, strong story that will inevitably give birth to a lot of really, really horrifying fan art.
Which it already has. Like, this thing is
huge on Tumblr. I did not Google search it for a reason.
I thought that, like, they haven't ever made a movie where the chief relationship in it that drives the entire story is just between two conflicted siblings.
Yeah.
And the romance is in the background. And, you know, even the snowman character, like I said, thematically it's important because it's representative of the bond between these two sisters that's totally lost for most of the film. Thematically it all just works. It's a really tight, really solid movie. I liked it a lot. And I thought, you know, even if you weren't like super into the Disney stuff, I thought you might still get something out of it. And I'm glad you did. So,
yeah.
I'm glad you did.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. It's a little trifle, but I enjoyed it.
But it's a good time at the movies.
It's a good time.
And go. I would recommend seeing it in. I Hope wants to see it again. She immediately put it in like her top five all time Disney movies. Yeah, she loved it. I'm almost there with her. I put it in my top 10 for sure. I'm the sort of person that has a top 10 Disney movies. I saw it in 2D. Did you see it in 3D or 2D?
2D.
Yeah.
Because I like not being in 3D.
Yeah. I'm not a huge fan of the 3D either, but with animated movies specifically, because I saw Tangled in 3D and didn't really appreciate what a gorgeous movie that was. Until I saw it on Blu-ray, because the colors all just totally pop.
So, yeah, 3D just makes them so muted and dull. And until the laser projectors come out, they're all going to be like that.
Yeah, and frankly, like I don't really want to see a movie where the color palette is such a huge part of the experience, and then that's like dimmed by 50% or whatever. And it's like, no. I you got to see what the color's popping. So, see it in 2D, I would say.
Yeah, that's a good idea. There's like 3D adds so little to the experience. I don't get it.
Yeah, no. I almost never see anything in 3D. I think the only last movie I saw in 3D was Gravity, and that was worth it. But
yeah, I saw Gravity the second time in 3D, and I was just like, why did I bother going back to this?
Yeah, I wouldn't want to. Talking about things I don't ever want to watch again, Gravity.
Yeah, the great movie, but. You can't watch it twice. You can't. It's all about the suspense of what's going to happen next.
Yeah, yeah, totally. I can't imagine sitting through that again. Let's see here. So, in terms of what I watched in the order that you gave them to me, I saw you gave me a film called Postman in the Mountain.
Yep, mainland Chinese film.
Yeah, which I didn't know was Chinese. Mm-hmm. Until I started watching it, and then it became very clear.
Right.
This is about a guy, it's a dad who has a rural mountain postal route.
Deep out in the sticks.
Yeah, way out in the sticks in rural China. You know, puts on the backpack, the backpack's got the tin cup, he's got the hat, and, you know, heads out into the woods, and he's got his trusty dog, Buddy.
3 days it takes.
Yeah, 3 days it takes to get to take this whole route and deliver all the mail and pick up all the letters and everything. And, Buddy's the best part of the film, by the way.
That dog is awesome.
And he's basically retiring. His knees are giving out. He's getting old. So he's bequeathing his route to his son. And his son is kind of brash and a little resentful because dad was never around when he was a kid. Because dad was always off in the mountains delivering the mail.
Right. And he's late teenager, so that would happen anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right. So he's in that phase no matter what. But So the son is going out for his first time on this route, and his dad decides sort of at the last minute to go with him and teach him the road, basically. And so these two, they go together through this route, and he sort of learns about his father's life along the way and sort of learns to empathize with his father a little bit more, and they sort of work out their issues. And it's if it weren't a foreign film, if it weren't a Chinese film, it would be I think if this were an American film, it would be sort of nauseatingly like treacly. It's very like heartwarming family stuff.
Yeah.
The issues on the page, the emotional issues that come up are never dark or anything. It's pretty simple, like surface. Well, Dad, you were never around, and he's like, well, son, I was off enriching these people's lives by delivering the mail, you know, and you learn about all the people that the lives he touched, you know, while he was delivering the mail, and how much he meant to these people as he went through through the mountains. And you know, it's sort of a father-son bonding experience, and they get to know each other a little bit better, and they understand each other. And then at the end of the film, you know, because at the beginning, of the dog is a little, thematically, the dog is important, because at the beginning of the film, the dog will not just go with the kid. He'll only stay with Pops, because they're sort of trusted life partners, you know. But at the end of the film, the kid's going off into the mountains, and the dog hesitates and then goes after the son, because that's the legacy. And you know, now you can fully appreciate my postal route, my son, you know, like that kind of thing. I've seen a handful of Chinese films. I've never seen one that wasn't intended to be some sort of event film, you know what I'm saying? So like,
right.
It wasn't like Hero or House of a Thousand Daggers or whatever that movie was.
Right, most of those aren't mainland either.
Yeah, they're not. Yeah, right. So this was probably the first thing like this I've seen. I liked it. It seemed a little trifly to me. I got a little frustrated because it was like a lot of foreign films. A lot of films from China and Japan, they hold the shot way longer than they need to hold the shot, and I get impatient. I don't understand the point of holding the shot that fucking long, but they do, and you gotta watch them walk across the entire bridge. Get to the next thing already. But it's not that long. It's only about an hour and a half. And I think as a family film, it's fine. I didn't think it was a particularly strong rumination on the relationship between father and son. It was just nice. You know, it was a pleasant watch. I enjoyed it. I didn't take that much away from it. How did you feel about it?
I love this movie, and I completely fall hook, line, and sinker for the treacle.
Okay.
I'm a sucker for family bonding films, just for the record. That said, what got me wasn't so much the father-son story, but for the almost every film that I've ever seen that takes place in rural China is about how miserable and poor everyone is and how crappy it is to live out there. This is a film that doesn't really completely, you know, make it seem like that's a nice place to live, but treats that area with respect and is nicely photographed. And it's just, it's one of those, atmospherically, you can just kind of sink into it and be like, okay, I can see how people would make a life out here. And, you know, one of the reasons that, to paraphrase Roger Ebert, one of the reasons to watch movies is to live lives outside of your own. And I can't think of a life more outside, more removed from the life I live than, you know, a peasant farmer in rural China.
You're totally right, and that's a good point. Obviously, my experience is dramatically more limited when it comes to movies about rural China than yours is. But literally, there's lines in the film where they're standing there, and he's talking about, you know, here's the benefit of living in the mountains. Here's what's great about the rural life. And a lot of it seemed to be like, hey, it's not so bad out here. Like, you know, these are good people, and we have a close-knit community, and
Right. And, you know, this being a mainland Chinese film from the 90s, I'm sure there was, you know, a very slight propagandistic edge to it. I mean, the way movies worked at that point in China, it wasn't, there were outright propaganda movies, but for most part, it was just a really strong censoring hand. And there really isn't anything to censor here. And I have no reason to believe that that's not a genuine statement.
No, I wasn't really looking for that, so I didn't see it. To me, it was just like, oh, this is a nice little family film about father and son getting to know each other and sort of getting over their prejudices against each other. And, you know, he's learning the route and learning what his father's life was like because his dad wasn't around because he was working the whole time.
Right. And that lesson was as valuable to me, I felt, as it was to the son, because I want to know what that kind of life is like. That is a very interesting, to a point, life that I have absolutely no experience with, and I never would have considered before this movie.
Yeah, yeah. It's a nice little movie. I didn't have a strong reaction to it, but I did enjoy seeing it. I'm glad I saw it. I'm interested. It did make me interested more in Chinese cinema, and I would really like to see more stuff from mainland China.
There's some great stuff in there, but man, if those long shots bother you, you've
well, that's what the fast forward button is for.
I do have some recommendations in that case, but one interesting footnote: this film actually got a fairly decent art house theatrical run here, and that I actually saw it in the theater.
Oh, really?
But it never got a home video release in the U.S. The company that released it, Cowboy Pictures, went out of business.
Oh, okay.
And ironically, they were the same ones that released All About Lily Shoo Shoo, but that got picked up eventually by Criterion's parent company. This one didn't. And so it was actually really hard to, I really had to seek out that copy that I gave for you. Like, that was a hard, hard thing to find.
Wow. Okay, then. Well, I appreciate it. I did enjoy the film. I thought it was pretty good. Apparently there's no real way for people to see this. So what's the next thing?
Okay, next thing for me is the 1998 Liam Neeson non-musical version of Les Misérables.
Okay, so I gave this to you because I just saw this myself. Hope brought this home and was like, "You got to see this." And we sort of watched it in the wake of that hideous...
Oh, that piece of garbage.
Terrible Tom Ford version with Hugh Jackman. Ugh. And Russell Crowe. Russell Crowe is in this movie.
Oh, God, that was bad.
And I actually really liked that movie.
I did, too.
And
so much better than that fucking musical.
Yeah. Well, it's... I understand the story now.
Yeah, that actually, I didn't realize just how many holes I had in that story in my head until I saw this movie. I was like, oh, that's why. Okay, now that makes sense. And, you know, see, here's the thing. As I mentioned earlier, I hate musicals, but Les Misérables is the one exception to that.
Okay.
The play, not the movie. And actually, in our family, that for a few years, that was a Christmas Day tradition that we would go to. There was usually a traveling show of Les Mis in town, and we would go see that.
Okay.
And I have great memories of that. And that's partially why the musical film was so disappointing, is because, you know, so many things that work on stage, and so many times where some people just stop the action and just sing for a while. That's fine on a stage, but on a movie, that's just death. This doesn't have any of that, and it cuts way differently. It paints its story way differently. Motivations make more sense. Javert's character in particular, like, I never really got his motivation before, and now I do. Now he makes sense. Right. And Jeffrey Rush is amazing as Javert, by the way.
Yeah, great. Like, it's so much better than any other portrayal. Like,
this is absolutely the best version I've seen to date
of
the story.
Yeah.
Without doubt.
I'm really happy
I saw this.
Cool. Yeah. No, I didn't even know you had that history with it. I just figured maybe you were familiar with the musical, and I was like, I had never even heard of this. I didn't even know it existed.
I probably saw it on Siskel and Ebert way back in the day and just went in one ear and out the other.
Yeah, right, because you're like, what, non-musical version, who cares?
Right.
It's pretty tightly paced. The performances are all really good. It's nicely shot. I think it looks pretty good. It made me really understand that story, and I don't know if I can go back to the musical version.
I don't think I can.
You know, it's like, if I gotta sit through that.
I do have one minor quibble with it.
Yeah.
The ending is really abrupt.
Yeah, it's very sudden.
Yeah, like, I would have, I'm sure, I've never actually read the book, but I'm sure there's more falling action. There definitely is in the play.
Right.
And I just, a little something there would have been nice.
Well, and the hilarious thing to me is that, like, you saw the Tom Ford version.
Yes.
Yeah. Somehow that movie, the 98 version, which was probably made for about $100 million less, looks so much better. Just in like the sets and everything, because during the revolution or whatever, quote unquote, towards the end of the film, the Tom Ford version, it already looked terrible. There it looks like the cheapest sets they could possibly have erected. Like, it's really claustrophobic. Everything looks like it was built yesterday. And they have, like, a couple of bed frames and some flags and some chairs and stuff stacked up. Mm. But in this movie, it's, like, realistic-looking, beat-up, worn-in, like, barricades. Like, it looks real.
It looks lived in.
Yes, exactly. It looks like... I'm sure there was a lot of location shooting. But it just looks so much better. And it's amazing to me that this version of this story existed for... 10, 12, 15 years before. And I had never even heard of it before. And it's like, oh, that's the good one.
Yeah, I'm glad we're talking about this because I feel like not enough people know this existed or just even remember it. There's no Blu-ray. It's just that DVD.
Yeah. And that DVD, when the which you can get now, like it's pretty ubiquitously available, because when the Tom Ford version came out in theaters, they started reissuing it really heavily. So you should be able to get it in like a $6 bin or something.
Perfect.
Yeah, I think that's where Hope got it. She just found it in a grocery store bin. So, go on Amazon. I'm sure it's like $10 or something.
If that. Hopefully it's one of those discs they over-replicated during the DVD bubble and now they're blowing them out for 75 cents.
Yeah, something like that. But totally worth your time if you're interested in that story. I like that movie a lot.
Yeah, I'm a big fan. I have to actually thank you for recommending it.
Okay. Oh, excellent. Hey, a success. All right.
Yay. All right. What's next for you?
Next I'm going to talk about this Russian movie you gave me. It won the Silver Lion, Golden Lion at Venice?
I think it was Golden Lion.
Golden Lion at Venice. Called The Return. It's on Netflix. People want to see it. Sort of the opposite of Postman in the Mountains.
Yeah, almost entirely the opposite.
Yeah. So this is a Russian film about two boys, two brothers. There's an older brother and a younger brother, and they're still kids. One's like in his early teens. The other one's a kid. He's like 9 or 10, and they don't have a dad. They're close, but they're getting to the age where they're starting to fight. And mysteriously, their father returns. Hence the title of the film. And suddenly wants to be their dad.
And the mother, you can tell she is not having it, but she really doesn't have
she allows it, but she's not comfortable with it. And the older brother is like, oh my god, I have a dad, and the younger brother is like, fuck this. And so they go on a road trip, a fishing trip,
quote-unquote fishing trip.
Yeah, a road trip / fishing trip. And after that, the movie kind of repeats itself for about an hour. Where the little kid is not trustworthy, and the older kid does, and the dad is... it reminded me of that Simpsons quote, like, no offense, but your half-ass underparenting was a lot better than your half-ass overparenting. And I wanted the dad to turn around and say, someday you'll thank me for all this scary love. So the dad's trying really hard, but he's also pushing them, like... he puts them through like these, it's kind of like he's putting them through these trials. Like it's kind of uncomfortable. Well, it's meant to be uncomfortable to watch, yeah, but
very uncomfortable.
Yeah. He's sort of pushing them. He's trying to be their dad really hard and just make up for 12 years of being gone. And he can't do that. So they go on this hideous trip together and they wind up going out to this island. Well, things go south from there.
Very, very far south.
Yeah. I feel like this was okay. I feel like it took a very long time to get to the point. I feel like they spent so much time repeating the same emotions that I grew tired of it, and I wanted them to just get to where they're going. There's so much time spent watching the little kid be upset and doubt and get mad and throw fits and just not accept the fact that this guy is his dad. And then the older brother tries to reassure him, and then he fights with him about it. And there's so much of that. And I was like, okay, I get it. You've established this. Can we get to the next thing? And I feel like the emotions and the characters don't really grow or change until the, you know, pretty close to the end of the film. They establish this stuff early on, and then later it's like, okay, now we're moving somewhere. But I don't know. It felt a little, it was molasses-y to me. It took too long to get to the point.
See, this is the kind of horror movie. I don't watch horror movies because I'm too realistic and, you know, things that are normally in horror movies like zombies don't bother me in the slightest because I'm too realistic.
Okay.
This is the sort of thing that, like, this is the sort of movie that keeps me up at night.
Well, it is a horror movie. Yes. That's a good way to
not to be mistaken for The Return with Sarah Michelle Gellar.
Oh, God. Yeah,
no, certainly. But it's like the atmosphere in the building. It really this movie freaked me out and it kept me wrapped.
I could, now that you describe it as a horror movie. Yeah,
like it's not just that kid is acting out and not trusting the dad. It's that kid is scared for his life because he doesn't know, you know, this guy from Adam, and he seems kind of shadowy, and we don't really know what he's up to, and he's not forthright with the kids at all.
Yeah,
and it's just from his point of view, and this whole movie is from his point of view. This is like the adults in my life have abandoned me, left me in the care of this guy that I don't know, and he's taking me to somewhere out in the wilderness, completely unfamiliar, and I don't know if he's going to kill us or help him deal drugs or what. And that's a freak out, and I appreciate a good freak out.
Yeah, I think just tonally, I think it lost me. I think it lost me in the middle. I picked up again towards the end. Once they actually got to, like, the boat, I was like, okay, we're just going to go. And, I don't really want to spoil the ending because I think if the premise sounds intriguing, you should check it out and see where it goes. but kind of the opposite of the Postman in the Mountains thing. This one is more about how family bonds, just because, you know, someone says they're related to you, it doesn't necessarily mean they mean anything to you, and they can be just as frightening or even perhaps more frightening than, you know, someone you actually, trust or something like that. It was okay.
Yeah. Okay. Not batting 1,000 here, but I wasn't expecting to. One sad footnote about this film, the kid who plays the older brother drowned in that lake. What? Almost like a week after they finished filming.
What?
Yeah.
Ugh.
Yeah.
I didn't need to know that.
Sorry.
That's depressing. Okay, well, great. God damn it.
Sorry.
Way to make the film even more depressing.
wait, I got more. No, I don't.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I think if you approach it as a horror movie, you probably get a lot more out of it. That's how I approached it, and I was too dense for that to actually occur to me while I was watching it. So, yeah.
Well, anyway.
Anyway.
Next movie for me, I'm very, very curious. I was very looking forward to talking about this because I honestly have no idea why you recommended it to me.
Okay, great. I was hoping so.
yeah, it is the 1935 Boris Karloff, Bride of Frankenstein.
The Bride of Frankenstein, yes.
A movie that was previously referenced in my head only in Howard Sternified clips of Ed Wood.
What'd you think?
It's really, really cheesy.
Yeah, it's real
really
campy.
Cheesy.
Well, it's campy.
Yeah, I mean, the acting's terrible. The science part has aged so badly that any third grader would know it's bullshit.
Uh-huh.
I guess it's kind of fun.
Okay, so here's why I gave this to you. I assumed, and I think probably rightly so, that Universal monster movies from the 30s are a huge hole in your filmic vocabulary.
Yeah,
I would imagine
good,
you have not
bet.
Seen. I would imagine you have not seen almost any of them.
Right.
You saw what I think is the best one.
Okay.
And I think those movies are important to see, just because they had such a huge influence. Like, you can see the influence that movie had.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, a huge amount of influence. Also, I think it's that one is the first one where they're sort of breaking out and getting weird. And the Bride of Frankenstein character itself, it's so strange. And the ending is really nihilistic.
That it is. Although, one thing about almost all movies from that era is they also have very, very abrupt endings.
Well, they're very short, and they have really super abrupt endings.
Yeah.
So it's like, they're dead, the end.
Yeah, it's like, oh, whatever, the end. Throw up the title card.
Yep. A Universal picture. Cut. Yeah. but I thought maybe you would get some enjoyment out of the camp, and the fact that I did like the sort of idea that he builds this bride for Frankenstein and she doesn't want it.
That did strike me as funny,
which is neat. Like, that's just, they're just having fun. Like, they're just saying, like, okay, let's get weird and crazy with this. Because it could have just been, like, the super standard thing, but that movie feels subversive to me. For the time it was made, it feels subversive.
I could see that.
I also think that there's something to the iconic look of the bride, which I think has just informed so much fashion since the 30s.
Sure.
That I look at that film, I see it's obviously the best of the Universal monster movies. Although, well, my other favorite is Creature from the Black Lagoon, which I probably won't subject you to.
I really feel like I don't need to see any more.
You should probably see the Boris Karloff Mummy. But I mean, those movies, they had a tremendous amount of influence. And they're not very long, so I think you can get a little bit of a film education just sitting through a few of them. But you did see, in my opinion, you saw the best one, which was Bride of Frankenstein, which not only was weird and totally one of the, I would say, like, that's the 30s, so one of the earliest examples of camp. weirdly subversive. So it's kind of like, I related to it more. I feel like the sensibility in it didn't feel like a movie from a time so removed from when, from my personal experience, like just in life and in watching films. I felt like that movie could have been made now, and it wouldn't be that weird or different or strange. It would feel like, oh, they're doing something sort of campy and over the top and silly and.
Maybe not, but by today's standards, it's so rote and boring.
I didn't think it was boring, but I like that.
Like,
stuff.
I'll be honest, you know, maybe not this specifically, but films like this and from this era, this is the shit I slept through in film school.
Well, they don't show this stuff in film school.
Oh, mine did.
Oh, they actually showed a lot of the...
We had a whole class of film noir.
And they showed Universal Monster movies in that?
Not in that one, but you know, they picked representative stuff from each genre from each era. Now we saw mainstream and non-mainstream stuff, stuff that they don't show in other film schools, certainly. And honestly, it didn't connect for me at all. And that room was very dark and over air conditioned, and I had my coat over me, and so warm.
Look, I went through that too, but that was the one I figured you would respond to the least, but I still kind of wanted you to see it. If I have the opportunity to say, like, hey, I think maybe you've never seen any of these. Here's the best one.
Okay. Well, coming at it from that point of view, I respect the recommendation and I'm appreciative of it. Yeah, not for me.
You were just sitting there going, why am I watching this?
Pretty much. And I literally it's streaming on Netflix, so I probably pressed the play button 3 or 4 times to see how much was left on the counter, and I'm like, oh my god, it's only like 1:17. Oh, thank god. Oh god, it's still only 47 minutes left. Oh my god, another 20?
Well, then, you know, none of the stuff you gave me is exactly like high entertainment, so, you know, consider that your penance.
Fine. Okay. That's fair. At least my last recommendation for you is one that you could talk through.
So the last thing on the list here is a 2.5-hour silent movie from 1921 by D.W. Griffith, who people only know from Birth of a Nation and Intolerance, and people haven't seen either of those movies.
And probably shouldn't.
And, well, Intolerance...
Intolerance is good. Birth of a Nation's awful.
If you want to learn about where filmmaking techniques come from, you can try to watch Birth of a Nation, but good luck to you. it's called Way Down East, and I actually really enjoyed this. I didn't expect to enjoy it. This was the one that you gave me that I thought would be a huge pill.
Yeah, you actually gave me shit about this one.
Well, you gave me a 2.5-hour silent movie. It's like, what the fuck, man? You always give me, like, these huge, depressing, like, slow pills to swallow.
Yes, stroke the throat like a horse.
I actually wound up really enjoying the experience of sitting and watching this. So this, in the tradition of D.W. Griffith movies, is a morality play, so to speak. It's like Tales of Constancy, effectively. And it's about a woman who, she's from the farm, and the farm needs money, so she goes to visit their rich, big city relatives, and gets wooed by a fop. And I do mean a fop. A fop who is apparently a huge pussy hound, but goes way the fuck out of his way to get laid. Like, this guy, like, will go through the most elaborate schemes just to fuck someone. So he basically woos her, gets her to agree to marry him. He goes through this entire process where they have a fake wedding. They get married, he fucks her. Then she's pregnant with his kid. She goes to him and says, I'm having your baby, and he's not going to be the baby daddy. So he says, fuck all this, and peaces out. Then she's stuck with the kid. So this is also in the 20s. Where that's the worst thing in the world, and you're a horrible pariah if you're a woman who had a kid out of wedlock.
Just to pause that, actually, it wasn't that bad in the 20s. This was based on a play from the 1890s.
Oh, okay. Well, even better then. So,
this seemed dated in 1921.
So she goes to a boarding house, which, of course, boarding houses in movies like these are always staffed by the most puritanical women in the world, and has the baby, and the baby dies. So she leaves and goes and finds work at a farmhouse, which has a Prince Charming guy living there. And they fall in love. And she's like, no, I'm a ruined woman. And he's like, but I love you. And she's like, no, I'm a ruined woman. And but I love you. And, you know, back and forth for a while. Anyway, it turns out, you know, baby daddy lives across the street. and keeps and shows up to this farmhouse's dinners and, like, you know, their social gathering, their barn dances, in fact.
Literally.
And it goes on from there. Basically, she sort of learns, sort of has to deal with this guy. And in the end, it's actually kind of progressive for a movie from the 20s. Because the guy who runs the farmhouse, who hires her off the street, who initially is like, she could be some strumpet. I will never hire a whore off the street. You know, gives into his softer nature and brings her in. He sort of has to be convinced. And then later in the film, he discovers her sordid past of having had a bastard child and all that. And at the end of the film, you know, 2.5 hours later, the foppish guy basically gets called out on his shit, and there's this whole what at the time would have been a big expensive special effects scene where ostracized from the house after everyone learns her terrible secret, the woman goes into the snow and then winds up on an ice floe in a river, melting river that's going over a waterfall, which is actually very impressive. Like, it's a pretty impressive sequence. And Prince Charming goes out and rescues her and brings her back. And everyone's like, oh, sorry, we were shitty to you. It's cool. You can stay here. And foppish guy, get the fuck out. And he does. And yeah, that's kind of it. But the act of you wouldn't think you'd be entertained by something that's 2.5 hours. And that's the story. But it is. I found myself very entertained by it.
It is strangely compelling and actually moves.
Yeah, it moves right along. It goes right along. There's all these, like, stupid comedy elements in it. Like, they throw that stuff in there to keep the people entertained. And, you know,
movie-going audiences back then were largely illiterate.
Exactly. And when you would go see something that's 2.5 hours long back then, there would be, like, an intermission, and this would be, like, an all-day event. Mm-hmm. Going to see something like this.
If you lived in a nice town, they'd have a live orchestra and things like that.
Yeah, exactly. And so this is a Kino restoration, which seems like it's held together by scotch tape.
Yeah, this film was badly deteriorated, and there are still a couple shots that are missing that were just beyond repair.
Plenty, actually. There's at least 7 or 8 of them. 7 or 8 missing shots. Lots of things where you sort of wanted to see file photo pop up at the bottom. You know, you can see the negative swerving in from the side, and there's lots of damage to the film print. But the restoration from what they had is remarkable, because you can tell the elements were horribly damaged. And so this is like, it's kind of like you see like an old like Greek sculpture and the face is gone, and somehow they managed to restore the face. And you're like, wow, holy shit. How'd you manage to get the face back on that thing? So it's good enough. If you're interested in silent film and you just want to see something compelling, it's a little sitcom-y, but it's relatable, and the characters are kind of fun. And it's fun to watch people in silent movies act, because they overact.
Right. No one has yet figured out how to dial it down for the screen.
Yeah, it's all very theatrical acting, and... you will also see some hilarious 1920s comic actor faces, which all had the kind of Popeye-esque lower jaw, huge nose thing going on. They look like cartoon characters, but they're actual people.
Right.
And that's fun. And I enjoyed the barn dance.
It is fun.
It's a really interesting little piece of cinema. Like, this is the kind of thing where, like, when you think D.W. Griffith, you think Birth of a Nation, you think Intolerance.
Right.
You think these giant sweeping epics. This is as long as those films are, but this is more like a romantic comedy or just sort of a trifle maybe that you would go see in a theater that you have a perfectly pleasant time in the movies at, but it's not this big sweeping spectacle epic thing.
Right. It's no Metropolis.
Yeah, it's not like Metropolis or anything like that. But it's just very interesting to see a movie that's just sort of populist entertainment that still manages to be entertaining almost 100 years later.
Right. And that's so rare. I mean, I've seen a lot of silent films. The number of them that I would still think are entertaining enough to show people are very, very, very few. So, anyway, D.W. Griffith was kind of known for being sort of old-fashioned back then, and I didn't think that any of his movies would still hold up to an audience today. But this one did, and I didn't really fully realize that till I asked my parents for a Blu-ray for Christmas. And I popped it in, and suddenly the whole family was in the living room. And the entire family was watching this movie from 1921. And I'm like, how often does this happen?
Right. Never.
Yeah, exactly. The damage is bad, and it's really cheesy. By the way, that river scene, the melting river scene, not special effects. They actually did that.
No, I figured. I figured they must have gone out and busted up a frozen river.
It wasn't rushing quite as fast as it looks, but Richard Barthelmess, who plays the Prince Charming, he said that he felt that arthritis in his knees for the rest of his life after that.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it was pretty awful. But I think it's incredibly entertaining, and I hope people check it out because it's one of those special things that, you know, how many times do people go, I'm going to go see a silent film?
Never.
Yeah. And, you know, there are good stuff. It's worth checking out.
Yeah, I would say, like, if you have friends who like movies, get this, sit around, watch it, make jokes. You'll have a good time.
You can really talk through it. It's cool.
Yeah, you can totally talk through it. But anyway, so that wraps us up. Justin, thanks so much. It's been a great year. And, here's to many more.
Awesome. And, happy holidays, everyone.
Take care.
Okay, that's our show, and that's our year. Big thanks to all of you for listening in 2013. Theme song is Bucharest by the band New Division. You can check them out at newdivisionmusic.com. Don't forget, leave us a little rating and review on iTunes. We really appreciate it. And we'll see you all next year.